Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
Perhaps not the easiest pair of games for Manchester City fans to watch this week, but not a terrible week by any stretch of the imagination. A hard-fought comeback win against Brentford was followed up by a hard-fought point against Inter. Maybe that could have been all three had Ilkay Gundogan had his shooting boots on, or his heading head, or whatever it would be. We'll take a look at those two games on this week's Blue Moon Podcast, plus we'll speak to the football historian Gary James after City played in their new fourth kit while at home to Inter Milan. It might surprise you that change colours have been used at home more than you'd think. And even that, if one person had their way, blue might not have been City's home colour at all anymore. We'll find out more later on. And on top of all that, we've got games against Arsenal and Watford to preview, including the tight turnaround between the two matches. Kieran Murray has been looking at what's been said there. I'm David Mooney, and with me for this one, I've got City fan and presenter with 442, Adam Monk.
Hello, hello, hello.
And from The Athletic, we've got Mark Critchley.
All right, how are we doing?
Not too bad, thank you, Mark. Not too bad. You well?
Yeah, I'm okay, actually. Sort of just permanently knackered. but, you know, that's just life, so it's all good.
Yeah, that's life in your 30s, though, and onwards, isn't it? So, yeah.
Basically.
Congratulations. Adam, you good?
I'm knackered as well.
Life in your 20s. There we go. Okay.
No, I've started a new personal trainer course this week at the gym, but it starts at 7:30, so I'm up at 6 now. So resetting the body clock, time to be a responsible adult, and it's horrific. I've had two Red Bulls already.
Excellent. Right. Well, we'll put that sugar to good use throughout the show then, in that case. Want to start with this. Mixed opinions on the definitely maybe kit, especially now that we've seen it up close. I'm not going to ask if you like it or hate it. I'm going to leave you, if you like it, to like it in secret. But I do want to know, what's the worst kit you've ever secretly loved? Adam, any absolute howlers that you've thought, you know what, quite like that?
No howlers. So, for instance, I think it was the 21-22 season. We had the third kit that was like a pyjama top with just Man City emboldened across the front. That was horrific. And I think that. But, like, the one kit that I really, really liked that I'd say got a mixed reception, initially when it came out anyway, was the Paisley kit. I think City's third kit of the 2021 season. That just really grew on me. I think when you saw it with the dark blue shorts, it was a very nice contrast, and I think one of the best third kits I'd say we've ever had. I'd probably rank it like top three in terms of the third kits, certainly in the modern era, and I think maybe some City fans wouldn't, so maybe that's like my hottest take on an unconventional kit opinion.
Yeah, Sam Lee described that one to me as like a Ted Baker shirt your dad would buy, and I've never been able to see it without that context. Yeah, Mark, any howlers for you? I'm gonna let you widen it out to not just City.
Thank you. I didn't. Yeah, that wasn't totally clear from the question, and I was trying to like again rack my brains. I did like the tequila sunrise kind of yellow orange City one from a few years back. That was my City contribution.
Genuinely, is a good kit. That I'm not gonna. I agree with you.
Well, this is the thing, like, what actually makes a bad kit? Because I think, you know, there's such like a, you've seen the boom in like retro kits. It feels like anything goes as long as it, like 20 or 25 years later, people think it looks good at a music festival. So I was trying to think of like something that was bad and nobody wears anymore. Do you remember Chelsea had one very early 90s that was like grey and orange? I think it was like a Coors, the Coors, when they were sponsored by Coors, the beer.
Not the Coors, the band. I didn't think Andrea and Jim Coore were sponsoring Chelsea.
No, that is quite 90s as well, actually. Yeah, I think that one is just, it kind of appealed to me because it's not so orange that it would clash with my hair, and it was also kind of grey enough to just go with any outfit. So I think I'd probably go for that. It's one that absolutely nobody's looking back on fondly, apart from maybe myself. So
excellent.
There you go.
Excellent. I saw, walking into the ground on Wednesday night, I saw, Mark, there's no chance you'll remember this. Adam, there's a very slim chance you'll remember this. But City had a third kit in about 97 that was yellow and black with like one black bar down the middle and then a black bar across the middle with brother. It's an absolute beauty. It was a limited edition, and I saw one last night going into the ground, and I almost stopped the fella and said, you know what, I am so pleased to have seen this shirt. Absolute cracker.
I wasn't then, alive in 97 days.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say something like that. I knew it. I knew that was coming. Right, so let's talk about the game then. Because Mark, think of all the interesting and useful and constructive things you could have done with your evening on Wednesday.
You know what? My mum actually rang me at half time, and I spent I missed basically the first 15 minutes of the second half just chatting to her. I don't call her enough probably. So that was actually a more productive use of the time. You know what? I've seen a lot of people complaining about the game and just saying it was quite drab and dull. And to be honest, of a lot of journalists that cover City, I'm probably one of the more likely ones to come on here and say, God, I found that 3-0 win against Southampton or whatever at home. So, you know, what a waste of time of my life and whatever. But I actually found last night to be quite... I don't know. I thought it was a good spectacle. Maybe my senses are completely off here and I'm just being a contrarian. But it felt that, you know, it was tight, it was competitive, and it was two teams that were relatively evenly matched, and I thought that made for a decent enough game, to be honest. Inter clearly had that threat on the counter attack. There's still a bit of a perception around Inter as though they can kind of be swatted off, and you know, Serie A isn't really up to the competitive standard of the Premier League, whatever, in these competitions. But I think they've shown, you know, in Istanbul clearly, and then last night again, and just the record last season. I mean, they won the Serie A by nearly 20 points in the end, and one of the best defensive sides in Europe. So that was a real test for City to come through. And I wasn't surprised that it was quite tight and quite cagey in places. But I thought it was competitive, and I thought it was a decent watch, to be honest. Yeah. But you two might completely disagree.
Well, actually, I'm being a bit facetious, because Adam, I was going to say, if City had played that badly against Inter, they'd have lost the game, wouldn't they?
Yeah, probably. It was always going to be a cagey affair, Italian low deep blocks. But listen, I know I come on this podcast as a City fan, and the main thing I've got to be is informative and somewhat enthusiastic about the football team I support. But I can wholeheartedly, hand on heart, say in my 25 years of existence, that is the most not arsed I have ever been coming out of a football ground in my life. I did not care one bit. I was working for the first time back there in, I think, two and a bit years last night. So it was a bit of a weird experience. And I was pitch side behind the goal. So my first take from the game was the fact that watching a game from that lower level where Pep watches it from, I don't know. I did not know what was going on. I could barely see down the other end. I couldn't really read the game tactically. And it just, I could see after 15 minutes it was going to be a turgid, dogged affair with minimal chances. And maybe we should have nicked it with Gundogan. But at the end of the day, the main takeaway for me, and I don't know if you've got this in a second question about the game, David, but my main takeaway when I left the ground was, I'm not a fan of this new format. And the reason I say that is because if that was a group stage game, right, a six-game group stage game, and we drew at home to Inter Milan, there'd be some jeopardy around that draw now, because it would put the pressure on us to go to the San Siro and win. But in reality now, we've just drawn that game. It means nothing, because we've just got to beat four fodder teams to guarantee qualification, basically. There's zero jeopardy around losing or drawing these big games, the spectacle games that they're trying to have every night for the TV rights anymore. And I just came out of it thinking, yeah, I'm not too sure about this new format. But in terms of the performance, pretty much what I expected.
Now, I couldn't disagree more there, you know, because what I really like about this new format of the draw is it's not just about getting into the top eight. It's about getting as high up the top eight as you can. So it means those end of group games, you might still need to win them, even if they're against the cannon fodder. There's no going away to Shakhtar for a dead rubber anymore.
Wait. But if you're in the top eight, you're in the... presumably pot one for you're in the favourable side of the draw, right?
If you finish first in the table, you can't draw second in the table until the final.
So it's like Wimbledon. Okay. It's like tennis, basically. Yeah. Yeah. It's like seeding system. Yeah. Well, I think I kind of feel similar about the format. I think that any sort of change in modern football just inherently makes it worse, and that's the kind of default position I take. Without any evidence to support it, usually. But I just assume that's going to happen. But I do feel like I'm almost willing to give this format one go around, you know, one season to see how it plays out. And eight teams to go through automatically isn't a lot. You know, we could all probably name the eight best teams in Europe, but there would be some differences in there. So there's going to be some edge cases, even not eight. What is it? Eight games in this phase. That isn't, if you think about a Premier League table after eight games, it looks quite different to how you would expect it to look by the end of the season. So I think that there are going to be some surprises, but the change in the format is probably only going to pay off in terms of excitement once we get closer to the end. And you're talking about those edge cases of, well, who's going to qualify automatically, who's going to be going into the playoff round, who's going to miss out on the playoff round. That's going to be the exciting bit. And like, if anything, you know, it's not great to start off with probably what is going to be City's toughest and most interesting on paper game of this phase first up, because like you say, the jeopardy just isn't really there when we all just assume that both these teams are going to go through. But it might not be the case, you know, because you know, a lot can happen, a lot can change in eight games. It's just not that many games to tell a team's true quality even.
Yeah, I mean, you said as well, Mark, that there were interesting bits of the game, and it wasn't a boring 0-0 for a lot of reasons. What impressed you about City? Because Guardiola said afterwards that he was impressed with the performance as well, and obviously City didn't score and didn't create a huge deal. What was it about it that kind of kept it alive like that?
I think it was, I don't know if it was so much about City's performance. Like I can kind of come away from that looking at it and seeing why a lot of fans would have come away from that game and thought, well, they haven't played particularly well there. I thought it was interesting that Guardiola said that they did. And if you look at the stats afterwards, I think, like, you don't put too much store into XG or whatever, but the XG was, I think it was over two, right? And most of that is the two Gundogan chances at the end.
Yeah.
Of course, but that, you know, if you look at that down on paper in black and white and the ones and zeros, that it still looked like a good performance. It's still more than like 20 shots against a team that, like I said before, I think conceded the fewest goals in Europe's top five leagues last year. So it's still, weirdly, you know, you'd look at that on paper and say it was still a dominant performance, right? But I think what I found enjoyable about the game is such and made it one of the more entertaining and interesting nil-nils was that Inter actually could mix it about a bit. You know, they were doing a lot of that last line defending. They were really backs to the wall at some points, but you also could see the way that they were very brave in the way that they were trying to build up play for out the back and the amount of players they were committing forward on the counter attack at times. I think that just made it a slightly different spectacle to a lot of other teams who come to the Etihad. Maybe other teams that come to the Etihad this weekend. We'll see about that. We'll talk about that later. But
Sommer was interesting because you think of how he struggled when Bayern were in town and under pressure, just couldn't do it with the passing out from the back. And then all of a sudden in this Inter team, he was brilliant.
Yeah, and so confident with it. And I thought the whole of the back three were just taking risks on the ball that you don't usually see opposition teams do at the Etihad. But I thought, you know, to City's credit as well, yeah, there were some times where they played through midfield, but I don't know. Look, they've still come out of the game on top in terms of chances, I think. But again, probably on the two Gundogan ones at the end. I just thought that it was always going to be difficult. It was always going to be an incredibly tight contest. The sort of thing that City perhaps just need at this early stage of the season to get them into gear. I don't think a point's a bad result. And look, for everything with the format, it's probably going to be deemed irrelevant in the end by the time we come to the end of it, because we fully expect City to still go through.
Yeah. Adam, the other side of this game, there was a lot of focus in the build-up to it for the ticket prices for it. Was it a £62.50 game for you? I mean, I've listened to this from Peter Schmeichel speaking to CBS.
I love good football and I like excitement from the crowd. It was dead. I mean, the Etihad today was absolutely dead. The only people we could hear was the Inter supporters. They were quite good. But there's no atmosphere in the Etihad today. And normally you think, well, big European nights, but it didn't happen for him.
What a knobhead.
Well, I was going to say, what do you think of ex-players with more personal wealth than you or I can imagine, who haven't paid a penny to get into a game for the vast majority of their lives, commenting on the atmosphere like that?
Well, so first of all, on Peter Schmeichel, someone made a good point this morning that he basically, he doesn't, let's just say, a lot of the sentimentality United fans used to have towards him before he moved to City has dissipated since he celebrated in front of the United fans at Main Road when City won that derby. And I think he's been trying to win back that adoration from some of the fans by sort of baiting City out. Because if you're a pundit, like, I think you can rise above that. That almost seems like it's like a soundbite. He's trying to get clicks out of it. Sounds that ridiculous. So first and foremost, I don't think the atmosphere itself was particularly that bad, given the occasion. First group stage of, you know, a Champions League group that's going to be 8 games long. Like, and especially you've got to think about where City have gone as a club now, like, which leads into the ticket pricing. There's a lot more tourists, particularly on Champions League nights, which does dilute the atmosphere slightly, other than maybe like the semi-final or if we play a quarter-final against a big side. So it's to be expected. In terms of the ticket prices, in terms of the game itself, was it a 60-odd quid game? No, absolutely not.
I'd just like to point out to the listeners, I am being facetious there. The prices were too high. Whether the game was good or not, it was too high. But yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, like, you know, maybe you could justify it that, you know, Inter Milan won the biggest clubs in Italy, City won the biggest clubs in England and the world now. On paper, yes, it's an absolute spectacle. But I think given where we are in the competition, and also just generally like the direction the club's headed in, I think it's too steep. And I think I've said this on this podcast before. In general, the club's model is pushing the common fan away, the match-going fan who lives in Manchester. What they want, ultimately, what Ferran Soriano wants and what he has set out to do clearly in like previous staff meetings I've been in, et cetera, is ramp up the ticket prices so that, you know, yes, you do still have your season ticket goers who can afford it, but then you're raking in the money from the people who are coming on a one-time basis once in the season, and they're going to spend 200 quid in the club shop as well as all the retail parts that they're building. That's what they want. They want a fan that's going to come and spend 400 quid on a game as opposed to 30 quid per match. And that's just the sad reality of modern football. And I don't think City are an outlier in this. I think other clubs are following suit with the model, and I don't agree with it.
It's certainly not a City-only problem. We've talked about it a lot. Yeah. The other game that was played this week, Adam, Brentford. If Inter was a tricky game, Brentford was also tricky, but for different reasons, I guess. They went man for man. They really accepted the threat that Haaland would pose, and that man for manness kind of unsettled City for a bit.
Yeah, Brentford are one of the best managed teams in the league because they've got one of the best coaches in the league. It's as simple as that. Thomas Frank, I think, is going to move on to. I'll call it now, actually. He will be Tottenham's manager before the end of the season. my words. I'm actually not joking. I think he's headed in that direction. I think he's very tactically astute. And listen, we've always had a tough time against Brentford. It's not just this season. Like, okay, maybe last season away was a bit of an outlier. You know, Foden kind of dispatched them on his own. But really, there've always been low-scoring games against Brentford. 1-0s, that 2-1 loss. They know when to be direct and efficient in transition. And I think they're actually a better team without Ivan Toney when they've got that two-pronged attack of Mbeumo and Visser. It's very, very deadly. And I think, like, they're one of those sides. They're almost like Brighton in the sense that they've got this talent pool and it's very Danish-based and a lot of the players are unknown entities, but they're very capable footballers. So, you know, they're a group of players that have worked together for the best part of 3 years at the top level. Now, they're never going to be any mugs. And I think Pep knows this. I think Pep went on record after the game saying, like, going 1-0 down against Brentford's a nightmare because he kind of expected this, that they were going to be very rigid at the back. And in many ways, you know, we should have scored more goals. Haaland hit the post and could have had a couple more. But, like, the first goal from Haaland was quite lucky with the deflection that sort of took the ball flying upwards. And it was just one of them where we deserved to win the game. We created more chances, but we also got the rub of the green in the way that we scored the goals. But yeah.
Lucky not to be further behind as well. Guardiola said that.
Yeah, possibly. I think, who was it? Collins had a header that was sort of directly at Edison, either side of him. That's a goal and it's 2-0. And then it's going to be a long day because Brentford are quite resolute. So yeah, listen, you're going to get some of those games throughout a season. I think City did well against a very good side. And there's not much more to it.
Yeah. Mark, you did the game. Was it a shock to see Guardiola make a double substitution at halftime, given that he's now done it in two consecutive games?
And I didn't think of it from that perspective, to be fair, but no, because I think Brentford had more possession than City at halftime. Like, they had, I remember checking after 10 minutes, they'd had 73%. It was like a performance that I haven't really seen a visiting side do at the Etihad in the past few years, to be honest. That certainly that first 20-minute spell, I thought they were just brilliant and totally deserving of being ahead for that period of time. But
if you're gonna go a goal down to Brentford as well in with that sort of performance, do it inside like 20 odd seconds, because then you've got 90 minutes to put it right.
Well, exactly. And look, I think even when it happens, you expect City to put it right, and you've seen these kind of slow starts that just on Saturday, but against Ipswich as well, right, with the Smodics goal. You expect it to turn it around, and look, I think once he made those changes at halftime, certainly with Rodri coming on, there was just more control, and it was a more standard performance that we used to see. And I don't think Brentford actually had a shot until right at the end with that chance. Was it Keane Potter? I can't remember, but there was a shot right at the end. That was the only one. Having been so dominant at the start, there was that shift in the middle. I thought that, as Adam says, you're going to get those games during the season. It's about managing those moments, and City did that in the end. Just a bit more physical, just a bit more about them in the second half that managed to pull it through. But I think most people went into that game knowing the problems that Brentford have caused over the past few years for City in particular, and not expecting it to just be a walk in the park, and it absolutely wasn't from 22 seconds in onwards.
And it's funny that the penny only dropped with me as well about 60-65 minutes, when nothing had really happened in the second half. City were leading 2-1, and I was like, I see what's happened here. He's put the ball in the fridge, that's what he's done.
It was that, wasn't it? Apart from, though, like, the last 15 minutes, do you not think it got a bit crazy in terms of, like, let's just try and get Haaland this hat-trick?
Yeah. But literally, I mean, you can't help but try and scratch that itch, though, can you?
No, I know. But I thought, as we were saying then, once you go behind so early, you expect City to turn it around, and they're 2-1 up by half time. I think that it was almost like everybody forgot that the score was 2-1 though, and it was like suddenly everything was just being drilled into Haaland. The piece that I did afterwards, my editor was like, "Do you want to write? We're just going to have to write about Haaland again." I was like, "Okay." What do you say? And I feel like I've been saying, what do you say about him since about the third week of his first season, right? I feel like it was just totally, there's nothing new to say. So in the end, we did went through every single shot that he's had this season, analysing it in how he takes the shots and what he does with them, and what his particular technique, and does it feel inevitable that he's going to score? And even going through all that, I was just like, I feel like we've done this before. We've all seen this story before, and everybody just wanted that hat trick to go in, and for him to just set another record, and for the B to, another thing to say about him, basically, because we're all just struggling for something new to say. But it was a bit of a manic end.
He did break another record though, Adam. 9 goals in 4 Premier League games to start the season is a Premier League record. It beats Wayne Rooney's 8. It's just getting silly now, really, isn't it?
Yeah, to be honest, there is a what more can you say, but I think he's actually massively changed his game this season. I did a little video on it a couple of weeks ago, and if you look at his goal map from the first season at City, it's very sort of Van Nistelrooy-esque. It's all centered around the 6-yard box, and it's where he sort of got that tapping merchant silly, label to his name. But if you actually look at where he's been scoring his goals from this season, the 9. Very, very varied, and a lot further out as well. And it means now that, I don't know whether he's fitter and it's just as simple as that, but he's scoring from all sorts of areas of the pitch, and it's not just those balls that are sort of hung to the back post or played across the face of goal. And also, he's added this... I'm sure you've noticed it, but he started chipping the keeper a lot more than he used to. He used to drag his shots and sort of get over the ball a bit too much sometimes in one-on-ones, whereas now he's almost giving himself that extra second, and it's just bearing so much fruit. He's chipped the keeper at Stamford Bridge, chipped the keeper against Ipswich, albeit rounding the goalie, and then West Ham, of course, for the hat-trick goal, he chipped the keeper, and then the second goal against Brentford, he chipped the keeper as well. And there's a bit of a pattern emerging now, because he didn't really used to do that. So I think it's actually made him more lethal in those one-on-one positions as well. So he's actually, I think he's getting better. And I'll go out on a limb and say, you just said he's broke Rooney's record there. I think he'll break his own record this season for the goals in a season. If he stays fit, I'm pretty sure he will.
It's easy to see at this stage, isn't it? I mean, I am going to open up a massive can of worms now, given the problems we've had on this podcast in recent seasons, defining goals as thumps and smashes and all sorts. Chips? Are they all chips, Adam? Because they're not dinks. They're certainly not dinks over the goalkeeper.
Do you know, I wrote, so when I was going through all the shots, I called those ones clipped.
Yeah, because he's clipped it. Clipped. Chipping, no, so, I feel like chipping, you've got to
go over the head.
You've got to dig under the ball, haven't you, though, more?
I think a chip is where you get under the ball. Okay, so it's like the technique of the shot. So a chip is a clip, but a lob is what Messi used to do where it's scooped, or what Robinho did against Arsenal. That's a lob.
Yeah, that's definitely that's a scoop or a lob. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so if it's scooped, it's lob. Okay. But if you're just getting under the ball, like a golf iron, that's a chip. I think.
So what's a chip and a lob then? Sorry, a chip and a lob.
This is like that scene from The Office. What's a goblin?
what happened to Seaman in the World Cup was a lob, wasn't it? He got lobbed there.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was certainly the joke everyone was saying afterwards, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was a lob.
Yeah.
But then I'd also put like Beckham's against
chip
Wimbledon.
Seaman doesn't really sorry, Adam, go on.
Yeah. No, I was going to say like Beckham's against Wimbledon, that was a chip. That wasn't a lob.
That was a chip.
Is that not far too far out to be a chip?
You can't chip someone from your own half.
Oh, you can't. David Beckham can't. He got under the ball. Yeah, it's basically a chip's where there's no follow through. Your boot hits the grass and then it stops, if that makes sense. Whereas a lob, it's got the follow through and the scoop. I make the rules, sorry. That's it.
One of these days I'm going to get Susie Dent on this podcast to actually finally, you know, clear it all up for us once and for all.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
You can listen to the show ad-free by joining our Patreon, patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
A few other bits to finish the first part of the show with. Adam De Bruyne went off injured. We'll find out a little bit more on Friday. But I felt like he was struggling a little bit with the pace with Inter as well. He seemed to be... this is an awful thing to say about somebody who is younger than me, but he seemed to be feeling his age at times.
Yeah, look, he's at that age now. We've got to be realistic. He's coming. What is he? Is he 34 or 33? He's 33, right?
33.
I mean, look, everyone's body's different, but to me, he's always appeared on the eye as if he's got a bit of that Wayne Rooney build about him, where like. Basically, what I'm saying is when I think he hangs his boots up, I think he's going to put on timber very quickly. I think he needs to manage his body a little bit more than maybe Fernandinho did at 33. You sort of got that more natural, leaner build, if you know what I'm saying.
There was the story he was doing that over the summer. Like he completely changed from his recovery from the last injury. He's really changed his diet and kind of how he deals with himself and like his recovery and all that sort of stuff. So I think he is doing that.
Yeah, I think it's one of them. Like it's the way De Bruyne has played the game from the middle of the park. It's been very explosive over the years, which is going to cause wear and tear. It was a similar case with Rooney. Obviously, he came through at a younger age than De Bruyne, and he relied on that explosivity and then kind of lost it. And I'm not saying De Bruyne has lost it, but it's waning. So when it's waning, I think you've got to start using him more sparingly. Now, of course, Inter Milan, it's a big game, and you kind of need him out there. But with Arsenal, you know... Arsenal are the team that he always seems to turn on the heat against. I'd have maybe not started him last night. I think we've got to start being wary about this. And I think given the format of the Champions League group and how I think we'll probably win at least six of the games in it, I probably wouldn't play him in many of the group games now in the Champions League. I'd just leave him out because we've got Foden who can play that position in the eight. Why he didn't start, I don't really know. But I don't think he's injured. I just think it was more precautionary. I might be wrong, though.
Mark, Rodri as well returned. He seemed a little bit rusty, and then there was the one point where he missed the challenge and gave the foul away and absolutely berated the ground, like beat the shit out of the floor.
There's only one winner there.
He's slowly coming back into it, isn't he?
Yeah, if he feels rusty, he should try playing some more games, you know maybe he just needs...
That'll get down well, yeah.
Maybe he just needs a more packed schedule just to get back up to speed. I thought, like I said before, I think, you know, there was moments last night there where Inter were really streaming through the middle of the park. And you know, you're going to get that sometimes when... I know he's getting help from Rico Lewis in there, but if it's a single pivot or single player holding midfielder and players are just running at you... You kind of expect that, and especially given the amount of time that he's missed at the start of the season. But look, I think I said it after the Brentford game, with him coming on at halftime, and just how there was the shift, and there was more control. Like, City are only going to get better for having the best holding midfield player in the world back and playing for them. So I'd only expect, I take it that last night there was a bit of ring rust, but he's got plenty of games to get himself back up to speed. So sure, that's not going to be a problem.
Yeah, and Adam, a quick word on Edison to finish. I thought he was great against Inter again. And actually, to be fair, great against Inter, barring the mix-up with Stones after 22 seconds. But other than that, he was pretty good.
Yeah, I've always liked Edison. His shot stopping has left little to be desired on occasion, certain seasons. But overall, I've always said it, like, what he gives you with the ball at his feet will always outweigh any shortcomings he's got between the sticks, because we don't concede many shots to begin with. So, yeah.
Another assist. Anyone... I saw. Did you see the video that City put out of all of his Premier League assists? And I remember seeing the one for Aguero against Huddersfield and thinking, like, it's a great ball over the top and everything, but it's not like Aguero's not had work to do there. He's ran side to side on the edge of the penalty area and then finally chipped the keeper. Definitely chipped the keeper, yeah.
I don't know if you remember this, guys, but like, so when Edison first signed and we had the pre-season in LA in 2017, Jesus and Aguero were up top in that pre-season, and they would start the goal kicks. I was showing Gaz at the BBC the other day. They would, so from goal kicks in pre-season, I think we played Tottenham and Real Madrid in two games, and Aguero and Jesus would sit in the opposition penalty area from goal kicks, and Edison was just trying to punt it the whole length of the pitch. And there was one time where Aguero received the ball against Tottenham in that pre-season and hit the post from the shot. Yeah. And it was like the longest goal kick I have ever seen in the history of football. And then as soon as competitive football started, we kind of stopped doing it. So, yeah, it's something we should bring back.
There's two things. I want to see him try that with Haaland, because if he can't be offside from a goal kick, so stick Haaland on the penalty spot and see what happens. Just want to do that. Also, I do remember that, Adam, because the very next morning I saw that City were 33-1 on Sky Bet to score over 100 Premier League goals that season. And I was like, I'm having some of that. And it came in with about five games to spare.
Yeah. God, we were ridiculous back then, weren't we?
Incredible team. Yeah. Right, well, City played in their new fourth kit on Wednesday evening, and it looked pretty jarring to see the home team not in their home colours. I assumed that this was a very rare thing, but after a bit of checking up, I found it's more common for City to have done it than you would think. I've been speaking to the football historian Gary James all about it.
Yeah, it's not as rare as you think. I mean, I think most fans will sort of remember back to the David James going up front game at the Etihad. But, going back, it's happened quite a few times. You know, there's I remember being at games where they've had to change, but also traditionally going way back, it was sort of like the norm in some ways. If there was a colour clash, well, prior to 1921, if there was a colour clash, the home team were expected to change in FA Cup competitions. So, you know, it was the norm 100 years ago, but in the decade since then, City have actually done it quite a lot.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the David James game there. I think it gets forgotten that City were in the away kit that day because of the madness of the way that game ended. But they were in the away kit. Was it the third kit for next season, I think?
Yeah, it was, because it wasn't even that season's kit. It was basically they launched a new kit for next season. I mean, obviously some sort of marketing idea at the time. And I do remember that at the time, most of us were not particularly happy about that. possibly because of the way the result went. You know, if they'd have won, it would have become a classic kit and so on, wouldn't it? But I think it was all about that, and obviously the bizarre nature of there being a kit made up with an outfield kit with David James's name on the back, ready for him going up front, you know.
If that had been a home kit, maybe that's different, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, if that was home kit, would we remember that game in the same sort of way? I don't know. We'd just remember it as David James played up front and Robbie Fowler missed a penalty. That's what we'd remember. But now, because of the kit, it takes it into a different dimension, I suppose. You know, it's and people do say, oh, you know, that's the only time. But it's not.
It's the only time at Eastlands, I think, is it?
As far as I can remember, yeah. Unless I've blanked something from memory, yeah. I mean, I do remember two games at Main Road in the sort of 80s and 90s, both against Tottenham. I do remember those. The first one was it 85, start of 85, 86 season, and City came out in blue and Tottenham came out in white. In fact, I think it was blue shorts as well, so white and blue, and we were blue and white, but it was our very pale blue that had only just been introduced that season, really. We'd been wearing a darker blue for the previous sort of, almost 8 years or so, we'd been wearing darker blue. And then Billy McNeil had said, let's go back to a traditional sort of pale blue. And so it was a pale blue kit, and the referee decided, I don't know if it was after, I can't remember if it was after 5 minutes play or what, but the referee decided one of you needs to change.
I can't see the difference here.
He couldn't say, I mean, there's all the usual jokes about referees and, you know, all that sort of stuff, but he couldn't, there's something about that, he couldn't see it, but it was an August day, it was, as far as I remember, it's sunny, it certainly wasn't a miserable, rainy sort of Mancunian day, and I remember being stood on the kit box and we were all like moaning, saying, Tottenham know what colour we're playing, you know, how dare they come up here, Londoners, what are they doing coming up here, telling us what kit to wear, right? And we came back out in the red and black stripes, and it's funny actually, because Sammy McElroy, the ex-United star, was then with City. And I do remember the cover of, I think it was the Next Home programme, had Sammy McElroy in the red and black stripes on the cover of it. And now, whenever I think of Sammy McElroy playing for City, it's only ever that image. I see him in red and black stripes, which is bizarre because it was home game.
Yeah, the other Spurs game, I found this one on YouTube. So Martin Tyler's the commentator, and he says at the start of it that City have kindly agreed to change to their maroon strip, it was. Because it was a foggy day and it was difficult for the TV cameras to tell the difference.
Yeah, and this now that one probably annoys me even more in some ways, because we were definitely wearing a certain shade of blue, and because it had happened before, you'd have thought Tottenham this time should have learnt the lesson and come in yellow. But no, here they come back in white again. You know, I think as well, to be fair, in the 80s and 90s, I still had a bit of a, and probably still do to some extent, had a bit of a hatred of Tottenham because of the 81 Cup final. So every time, like in 85, you know, it's only 4 years after the 81 Cup final. So every time Tottenham makes City do something that's negative, I'm thinking, you know, 81 Cup final.
They're taking the piss here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So when, you know, when eventually we start to win trophies and when eventually we beat them 4-3 in an FA Cup game and all of that, then I feel we've got, you know, justification for everything we've ever done. But yeah.
It happened, I didn't realise it happened quite as regular as it did in kind of the 60s and 70s as well.
Yeah, I mean, the late 60s and the early 70s, it seemed to be the thing. So the red and black stripes were worn against Chelsea in the European Cup Winners' Cup semi-final. So, it's happened in Europe, certainly, before.
And that was at Main Road?
That was at Main Road. And obviously, City and Chelsea, we both traditionally wear blue, but it's a different shade of blue, you know. There's not quite the same.
They've certainly played recently with both teams in the home kit.
Yeah, and that does annoy me. Whenever Everton or Chelsea arrive here in blue, I'm thinking, come on. And it's probably thinking back to that Tottenham stuff, you know. But in 71, so it was the European Cup Winners' Cup semi-final, and unfortunately we lost that game. But I think that, and the other cup games that we played around that time in red and black, we played Wigan, we played an Anglo-Italian Cup game, so again, we've played Italian opposition in other than blue at home, wore red and black. I think that was more Malcolm Allison's idea. I don't think anyone told us we had to wear away colours those days. I think Malcolm Allison wanted to do that, because also this fits with around that time, Allison actually talked about City adopting red and black stripes as the home kit. So maybe he felt, well, in the league we've got to wear blue, but in some cup games, let's wear red and black.
Yeah, we can make this to our advantage as our kind of a second home kit, maybe in a cup competition.
Yeah, but even before that, in the late 60s, they'd won maroon for a couple of cup games at home. So it's one of those things. I've not done loads of research on this over the years, but it's one of those things that's always been in the back of my mind, that almost every decade up to that Spurs, those Spurs games, almost every decade, City have worn away colours at home for a cup game of some description. So 1924, City end up getting through to the FA Cup semi-final, but in one of those rounds, in the build-up to that, we play at home and we choose to wear what we described at the time as lucky scarlet. So it was a form of red, right? But lucky scarlet, because we'd won, you know, some of the other games in that, and they made a point of saying we're going to wear lucky scarlet, and that was against Cardiff. So at the time, it was 76,000 crowd. It was the record crowd in England at the time. And City away in this lucky scarlet, Main Road's first season. 1930s, the cup runs, certainly 1934, they wore maroon for some of the home games. Typically, it's when we're playing Everton. For some reason, games against Everton, we often changed. And that happened again in the 50s. You know, 1956, was it? There's a FA Cup game against Everton. And again, we chose to wear our away colours.
Thinking about it then, if they did it in the 20s, the 30s, possibly the 40s, I'm not sure.
I don't know if there was enough cup game, but possibly. I mean, the war obviously
has an effect there.
Yeah,
so, but then the 50s they did it, 60s, 70s they've done it, 80s they've done it, 90s they've done it. Noughties they did it with Middlesbrough, they didn't do it in the 10s. So the 10s is the only decade.
The 10s is the odd one. Why didn't we do it? But it just shows you, you know, obviously, you know this as much as I do, but we often talk about traditions in football, and we talk about that's never happened before. This is a first. Why are we doing this? Why are we doing that? The truth is that some of these things just happen, and they have happened forever. There's almost anything that could happen in football has happened at some point in the past. So wearing your second kit or your third kit or your fourth kit, yeah, well, it's one of those things. Now, personally, I would always want City to wear blue, home or away, you know, to be frank. If we're playing at Anfield, why can't we wear blue? Why do we have to wear an away colour? Let's wear blue. And I would like to see City wear blue all the time. But, of course, that's never going to happen. And I understand why sometimes games get changed. I think the reasons vary over the years. Sometimes it is because, you know, there's a rule in place and you have to change, like it was in before the 20s, before 1921. Other times it's because your manager just likes a particular kit. And then other times, obviously, there's marketing ideas or it's to do with, you know, a general buzz that's going around the place. And sometimes it's, well, maybe the referee's fault or Martin Tyler's fault. I don't know.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Listen to it. Drink it in.
That was Gary James talking to me about the times where City have worn different kits at home. We're now joined by Arsenal fan Michael Kashani. Hi, Kesh.
Hi, David. How's it going?
Not too bad, thank you. We're going to talk about this game coming up on Sunday. How are you feeling about it to start with?
Mixed, honestly. I think the fact that we won't have Odegaard is big and means that we'll probably go in very, very defensive, try and nick one on the break, much like last year when we didn't have Saka. But we're also very, very good at doing that. So there's a reasonable chance that we can actually come away with a pretty good result, whether it's a draw or even a win, God forbid. But yeah, it's not going to be an easy way there.
Yeah, you don't see. I mean, it's one of those games. You look at the game that you played at the Etihad last season, and it was very much a case of Arteta protecting what he had before he then tried to get anything else out of it. The game plan's surely going to be the same, isn't it?
You'd expect so. I mean, we'll have Rice back, which is big. We didn't have him against Tottenham, and it wasn't a great performance, but it was very much a deserved win kind of game. So I'd imagine it would be pretty similar. Try and nick one, because obviously trying to go toe for toe against City at the Etihad is, well, it's bold to say the least. And without Odegaard, I just don't think we can do it. But as I say, we are very strong defensively, and I think if we can play more in terms of that, we can play more in terms of absorbing and then really trying to hit you a bit harder on the counter, because I think we missed a little bit of a trick. We came out of our show a little bit too late in this game last season, and sort of last half hour or so started to make those attacks, started to build those inroads. But if we'd maybe gone 10 minutes earlier, then we could have built a bit more pressure.
Yeah. Adam, for City in this one, I guess having a game against Inter in the midweek in the way that they've just had, it's kind of nice preparation, because Inter defended really well. You'd expect Arsenal to defend really well as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this game, the result of this game is going to be fully dependent on how Arsenal execute their game plan. We know what City are going to do, and to an extent, we also know what Arsenal are going to do. I think Arteta got it spot on at Tottenham, given the fact that Rice and Odegaard weren't available, in the sense that he kind of sitted and waited and then hit him with that sucker punch, obviously, on the set piece. So my only worry would be that, you know, against Brentford last weekend, City conceded a few set pieces where Brentford maybe could have capitalised and done better with the chances. And Arsenal have got such an aerial threat that I think that's how they'd probably score their goals, similar to how they did at Tottenham last weekend. So with that said, I think it's going to be cagey. We know what Arsenal are going to do, and it's really a matter of perspective if you're an Arsenal fan as to whether you liked what Mikel Arteta did at the Etihad last season, because you could argue it cost them the league, but then you could also argue that it was that Aston Villa result at home that really cost it for Arsenal, because they kind of, at that stage in the season, they did what they needed to do at the Etihad. And I think with it being early doors in the season, you know, not everything is on the line. Either side could lose this and they're still in the title race. I think Arteta is going to be cautious. I think it'll be low scoring. But I think Arsenal, given how they performed at Tottenham and executed the game plan, in my opinion, perfectly, I think they'll have a bit more goal scoring threat than they did last season when they came here.
Yeah. Kesh, Adam's just said there about the narrative around that game from last season. And I guess it almost comes down to what you want out of a football game, doesn't it? Because you look at the way Arsenal approached that game last season. City weren't at their top level by that stage of the season. They were still trying to figure themselves out, which they did go on to do in the weeks afterwards. So there was maybe a missed opportunity there, but at the same time, it was still in Arsenal's hands after the game.
It was. I don't look back at that City game with any kind of regret, to be honest. I was at the Villa one, I think it was the next week, and that's the one that will stick with you because it was completely avoidable. I think with City as well, it's easy to say that we went and we played to defend and sort of tried to get out with a draw. I think it's true to an extent, but at the same time, it's not like City went at us full throttle. That they didn't leave those gaps for us to try and take on the counter. And like, if you want us to go to City and try and dominate the ball, it's just not going to happen. And so I think it was a sensible approach. And the way that it was in our hands at that point, we know how City get towards the end of seasons. It was just, it's not worth, we could have easily have lost the league there by losing the game. Like I say, I don't look back at that game and think that's where we lost it. It's all about that Villa game and our really bad run in December. But as you say, I think I'd be interested to know what he might have done as Arteta if we hadn't drawn against Brighton a couple of weeks ago. Because I think he'd be more inclined to say, fuck it, maybe we can risk losing here if we might get the win instead. But, you know, when you've drawn one very stupidly so early in the season, it sort of sets the caution up. And I think it will send him back to be compact, defend, make sure we don't lose, make sure we don't lose sight of them before we have a chance to really put a run together.
Yeah. Mark, do you think for City in this game, bearing in mind, like we talk about Arsenal's approach to the game at the Etihad last season, City's approach to the game at the Emirates last season was very much the same. It was very much gum it all up and try and make nothing happen for a long spell in that game. Do you think City need to lay down a marker in this? Because they didn't beat Arsenal last season.
No, they didn't beat them. There was no goals either, unless you're counting Palmer's in the Community Shield, which... I'm not counting because he didn't win the game, so and it doesn't fit my argument.
It doesn't fit the narrative, yeah.
So let's just disregard that. But no, I still think it's pretty telling that, you know, no wins but no goals. I think they must have been the only team to top City from scoring against them last season. I think that, yeah, look, there's a little bit of impetus around it, but we both know what to expect from these two coaches, right? I think there's going to be a desire for control from both sides of the game. I expect Arsenal to set up in the same way that I probably rate Arsenal as the best defensive team in Europe at the minute. I know we've just spoken so much about Inter and how good they were last night and how good they were last season, but the way that Arsenal set up and to dominate, not just through control in the way that City do, but also physically with the height and the power that the players have, it wouldn't be surprised if there was a point on Sunday where they probably got five centre-backs on the pitch, right? Across the back four, then maybe Calafiori coming in as well. They just set up in that way to really, control games. I think there will be, impetus on City, but it's still so early in the season that I don't think... It's weird because you can make that argument both ways, right? I think when they were playing in March and it was getting down to the crunch, people were like, well, neither's going to want to give an inch. Same applies, right, at this point of the campaign as well, and we saw that at the Emirates when they played last October. I can't see anything other than the two teams sort of cancelling each other out and a repeat of the game in March, to be honest. But that's just the way I see it.
Yeah, if that happens, how does that go down with City fans, do you think, Adam?
I think it's accepted. They're the other best team in the league, bar us, and it's early in the season, so I don't think you can really kick up a fuss. It's just, if we give it a go, I think maybe last season a few City fans felt there was a sour taste in the mouth because maybe we didn't give it enough of a go at times. And we were, I think like Kesh said, we were also cautious and didn't really leave Arsenal the spaces to exploit us. If it's like that again, and there's not many chances in the game, and it's much like that Inter Milan game last night, then I think there'll be a few moans and groans. But I think we're gonna take the game to them. I just think it's, if the effort's there, I don't think the fans will be up in arms. I think we'll nick it slightly. I think it'll be 1-0. I think it'll be very, very tight. I think we'll probably find a breakthrough purely just because of how well Haaland's playing at the moment.
Yeah, we'll come to your score prediction later, so you have spoiled that for us there. But Kesh, if it is another kind of like tactical battle finishing 0-0, would that be a good result for you guys as well, coming away from it, do you feel?
Yeah, I mean, as we've said a few times between all of us, it's early in the season. For us, the task is staying very much in the conversation until the time you step up. You guys know better than us how these title races work. It's not about what you do in September. But so yeah, I would happily take it, especially without Odegaard. Like, he's a massive, massive miss.
How will that affect things? Is it like has it really changed what Arteta can do on an attacking front?
It's tough to know because he's only missed the one game so far, which was Tottenham, and we also missed Rice in that one, so it completely changed how he would set up. And the problem is we don't have anyone you bring in instinctively as his cover. We've got a boy called Ethan Nwaneri, who is 17. He looks impressive. I would be absolutely amazed if he starts either tonight or we've got Atalanta tonight or on Sunday. I think he'll get some minutes in the home games, and then they'll try and sort of blood him in for that. I think if I had to guess, I'd say that he's going to move Havertz back to 10 and maybe play Jesus up top. And it does change the way you can play, because Havertz is great. I'm a huge fan, but he's not going to move the ball as slickly as someone like Odegaard. We're not going to find those passes in the same way. We're going to have to be a much more direct side and a much more physical side off the back of it. So, it might help. Almost it helps. It's never going to help to miss arguably your best player, but I think it's going to enhance the approach that we probably would have taken anyway.
It makes a decision for Arteta.
Yeah, but it also might mean it's harder for us to find the finesse that we'd need to find that way through. Mm. I think in that as well, I wouldn't be shocked if City decide, or Guardiola goes early and just tries to hammer us for the first 15-20, doesn't let us settle into any kind of defensive rhythm. We're expecting this sort of tight, cagey game, so we wouldn't be as prepped to go straight on the counter, as it were. Mm. And City try and get that early breakthrough, because if someone scores in the first half hour, think about the game in either of the games last season, as we've said, they're completely different matches. I think the only goal that happened was 87, Martinelli's one. So yeah, I could see him really trying to make us uncomfortable very early, and then if that doesn't work, knowing that we've probably not launched a few intense counters, and you can settle back into the game that we all expected almost.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
Mark, we'll get clues when the team sheet comes out what Guardiola's approach will be, because it's whether you go for like Bernardo and Grealish on the flanks, or whether you go for Doku and Savinho on the flanks, or maybe a mixture of both, isn't it? If he's tempted to stretch the game and open it up a bit, he'll play the players that are more likely to do that.
Yeah, I mean, what do you seriously expect, though?
Yeah, it's Grealish and Bernardo all day long, isn't it?
I feel like it might be. I think it was Foden and Bernardo on the wings last season, right? For the corresponding fixture. Look, I think it'll be interesting to see whether Foden's ready to come back in. I think a lot of fans would want him to. So there's that, and that might throw a little bit of a spanner in the works. Ødegaard is a huge miss for Arsenal, I think, just because, as well, as good as he is on the ball and in possession, he's brilliant out of possession as well. And that, I feel like, you know, he really leads that press. He's probably the best at that in terms of a number 10 doing that. He's probably the best at that in the whole league, right? And Arsenal's game plan is going to be focused on what they're doing without the ball rather than what they're doing with it. And I think that is a huge advantage to City, that he's not going to be there. You know, they cope so well without him. And I know they had less possession against Tottenham as well. But I just feel like, you know, having talked myself into a 0-0 and even predicted that for later in the show.
More spoilers. Yeah, I see how it is.
Spoilers. Sorry. Christ. But yeah, I feel like if there's any way that City can really get at them, it's because Arsenal won't be as perhaps well oiled out of possession and in that press as they usually are, because they're missing Odegaard, and that's potentially where City can get ahead in the game.
Yeah, Adam, do you like the idea of going gung-ho at Arsenal for the first 10 minutes, see what they're made of? Because funnily enough, I was talking about this recently with Sam Lee about how City are so controlled, and yet sometimes when they've got kickoff they just go, we'll stick it forward, see what happens.
Yeah, I hope they do, because that's, I guess, what we're all paying 70 quid for a match day nowadays. So, you know, hopefully. I mean, like this, I think the game I always think of is Real Madrid at home 2 years ago, where we just slaughtered them and didn't let them breathe for the first 45 minutes. And I'd love to see something like that again. I think we're capable of it. And yeah, Pep sometimes does do it in big games.
Is that the difference between April and September City, though?
Yeah, it is. I was going to say that. You took the words out of my mouth. It is. It's situational. I think when we're on that running, we can just sort of turn it on. But, you know, like the stakes aren't as high as I think, you know, Sky Sports will have you believe before this game. Like, it's just the truth. What I would say tactically, I think if De Bruyne has got a niggle and he's not fit to start, I don't think Bernardo will play out wide. I think he probably comes into the middle, because I think it gives us a bit more press resistance, you know, on the ball, but also the ability to win it back and maybe nick it off the likes of Rice when Arsenal are trying to break or get out of their own defensive third. I think Bernardo in the middle gives us that bite, and then maybe we put Foden on the right-hand side. But that's obviously whether De Bruyne feels up to the task on the day. But yeah, I'd like to see us have a go straight off the bat. Why not? You know, energy's at the highest level, and if we can get an early goal, that sets the tone. I think if we go 1-0 up early, that's probably curtains, because that's a massive psychological mountain for Arsenal to then climb if they concede early. We've seen that in the past at the Etihad.
Kesh, how have you been playing under pressure? Because I guess you're in that mould now these days where not a lot of teams press Arsenal as much as they may have done in the past.
I think it's probably a similar situation to City, where in large part a lot of teams don't really press us because there's not really much point. We are very good at playing out. All our systems are, you know, they're the systems that you guys have seen. We're very good at, everyone knows exactly where everyone is. It's the automatisms, as Arteta and Guardiola like to talk about. I think I've said that right. It's their actions, they always get in the way. But but yeah, we've got all very pressure-resistant players, apart from, and I think the big, elephant, there's a number of elephants in the room when it comes to him, but Thomas Partey, who is just, leaving aside everything else, is also really fucking crap now. He's really bad. And City are going to press the fucking life out of it. Sorry, he makes me mad for very many reasons. Some that would get you in trouble. So if I'm to state them. But yeah, he's going to be the target for City because he's not pressure resistant anymore. He is really lax in possession. He lets players drift behind him. Like when we had the 0-0 in, was it March last year? As soon as he came on, he hadn't played all season really. But first thing he did was exactly the same thing he did in the 4-1 when we let the league go for sure in April 2023, which is just let De Bruyne walk behind him. And he's going to do that at least three times to whoever's playing against him. And if Bernardo has the job in the middle without De Bruyne there just to press the life out of him, then City are going to find a lot of joy out of that. Mm. And whereas if he comes to his senses and starts playing Jorginho, which I really don't think he will, then, you know, Jorginho's not perfect, but he is a lot smarter at playing out in that way. So again, it's one of those things where if we are inclined to go more physical and we don't have Odegaard, we won't be as good at the actual football side of things, but we will be more physical. If City want to press that little bit more, then they've got the ideal one in not having De Bruyne and then having Bernardo there to exploit our weakest area.
Yeah. Just finally, Cash, as well, before we get a prediction from you, you've mentioned the Atalanta game this evening. You've got a very short turnaround between playing away in Atalanta and then coming to the Etihad. We'll talk a bit more about City's turnaround between Arsenal and Watford shortly. What's the feelings around that? It can't be convenient at all, can it?
No, it's not positive. The fact that there's Champions League on a Thursday is a disgrace. But you know, you leave the Europa League to get away from these things. But, you know, this is the way of these things. You got to deal with it a lot. There'll be probably some fairly healthy rotation. Arteta will flog the life out of every player he can, or at least the main players, before he ever considers rotating them. So I think regardless of tonight, I'm hoping no more injuries, then you can make a pretty solid prediction at our 11.
Okay, well, we've already heard what the other two are predicting for the charity bet later on, so give us yours. We'll hear that now.
Despite all of that, I'm choosing to be optimistic. 1-0 to the Arsenal.
Excellent. Well, I hope that's not true, and I hope one of the others is correct. But we'll catch up with you later in the season, Cash. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks very much. Always a pleasure.
We'll see you soon. Now, there are about 51 hours between kickoff in City's game against Arsenal on Sunday and the start of the Carabao Cup match against Watford on Tuesday. The club haven't been happy with the scheduling of these games, a problem exacerbated by Manchester United's home tie with FC Twente in the Europa League that week as well. Kieran Murray has been looking at what's been said this week.
The extent the Champions League format this season has already created a problem. Because of a tight schedule, Manchester City will have to play Watford in the League Cup just 2 days after facing Arsenal at the Emirates.
It's going to happen many cases. It's going to happen many, many times, this kind of situations for the teams to play in all competitions.
That's Pep Guardiola speaking about the issue recently. It's happened because of the Carabao Cup draw. It was seeded to keep European teams apart. If two teams in Europe were to draw each other, then there would definitely be a fixture clash. But there's been one anyway. That's because City have been drawn at home and their tie was due to be played in the week where Manchester United are at Old Trafford in the Europa League.
Now the problem that Tuesday against Watford is the problem with schedules. It's no more days. A week is 7 days. We are not create 8 days a week, 9 days a week. No, that's going to happen. Just 7 days. So you have to fix all the games and the schedule is so tight, a lot of games, so it's impossible to handle it.
There was a solution offered to City, though, in an attempt to give the players more rest.
So they give an alternative to play on Thursday away in London to have more days, but that you have Saturday game in Newcastle and we prioritize, of course, to have more rest for Newcastle and we're going to play on Tuesday because we cannot play on Wednesday, then apparently it should be because play United Europa League and for the police is not accepted, so but it's going to happen many times.
The club confirmed shortly after that City were offered the chance to flip the fixture to Vicarage Road. Guardiola misspoke when he said there that they were offered Thursday away at Watford. They were actually offered Wednesday, but still declined the offer.
I prefer to play at home because the draw was like this. I'm going Thursday to London. I prefer my fans, our people, to watch his team, lovely team, adorable team at home. So that's why I decide to play on Tuesday. Because on Thursday after that, you have recovered, but that you don't have recovered for to go to Newcastle. I said many times, we're going to change. The meetings is useless. So they decide to do it, we're going to do it. Tuesday we'll be there. Hopefully we can select two teams and be fit and no injuries and don't make energy, but everybody knows the schedule will be tight this season, accept it and go on.
There's a fine balancing act to be done. Moving the game to Wednesday gives an extra day rest after Arsenal, but it also means more travelling before they go away to Newcastle for the early kick-off the following Saturday. Guardiola was asked if it was possible for a player to be involved against Arsenal on Sunday and then again against Watford 2 days later.
Hopefully not, but I don't know, you have 20 players available and can do it, I don't know. But I don't want to make on Tuesday, try to play, you know, play the play against Arsenal, play there. I would try to avoid it, but hopefully we can be fit and no injuries, and the guys who didn't play in Arsenal are going to play against Watford, that's for sure.
Guardiola also said that the fatigue is just as much mental as it is physical.
It's not the rest for physical, it's really mental. So when you have a game, you have so much stress in here, the adrenaline and everything. You're playing against 65, 70,000 people, you want to perform well. You don't make a ridiculous performance and make your team down, and that's why sometimes it's not your attitude, it's okay, today I don't play, a little bit breathe.
This is also why, especially towards the end of the season, when the fixtures are coming thick and fast, Guardiola says he doesn't get his players to do much in training.
When you are fresh, it's much better. That's why today the training sessions is nothing. It's come up to say hi, to laugh a little bit and prepare the next game. Training, you know, quite... Now maybe a little bit more, but when you're in February, March and April, or maybe December, January, February, the schedule is terrible. So in that situation, it's just, you know, it's a rough energy to the game. It's what I learned. So when you are in the clubs that play a lot of competitions, it's keep the energy to the moment of the game. So it's not interesting the day before training good or the day after, because you need energy for the 95 minutes they're going to play.
And that is perhaps why Guardiola prefers to keep things as they are. While there might be very little time after finishing at Arsenal to prepare for the League Cup match, a home fixture with home advantage should be, if everything goes to plan, less energy sapping than another midweek away trip.
Hi guys, it's David Seaman, ex-City player. I've played a few times for Arsenal as well, and England, but you're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast.
Email the show through our website, bluemoonpodcast.com.
That was Kieran Murray taking a look at the quick turnaround between Arsenal and Watford. Mark, for this one, how different do you think the two teams in these two games will be? Will Guardiola just go out there and make 11 changes, or will he do the thing that he always does and kind of make two or three and talk about rest and rhythm, and they'll work it out somewhere else later down the line?
I think that this is such a kind of unique set of circumstances that you'd have to be looking at an almost completely changed team, to be honest. I don't look, it's a prediction, like five days out from the game even. Mm. But you can sense, I mean, I think we were both at the pre-Brentford press conference last week, and this was a topic that just kept on coming up. And, you know, I think we've all had our fill of Guardiola quotes about the schedule and just how many demands are on players, et cetera, et cetera. But it's something that the club are clearly quite frustrated with. They had the option, well, they presented with three options essentially, which was either play it on Tuesday, play it on Wednesday in Watford, given that United are playing that Wednesday night, or reschedule it for the Thursday. And then you have the same problem because they've got a 12:30 kickoff against Newcastle on the Saturday. So there's no good option here, right? Of three bad options, essentially. And I think in the end, the City are probably plumped for the best one, because let's face it, priorities have to be priorities, and you have to dictate that the league comes before the Carabao Cup,
despite the affinity, despite all
our yesterdays together in the Carabao Cup. Unfortunately, the league has to take precedence, and those are two incredibly tough games that are really important, even at this stage of the season. I can understand the decision, and I think it'll be. I was trying to find like if there's ever been, you know, a similar kind of precedent for it. And it was when we were at the presser last week, actually, somebody brought up that United played Liverpool in 2001 at Old Trafford, and then played Arsenal in the League Cup the day after. I have absolutely no recollection of this whatsoever. I don't know if you, I don't expect anyone on this podcast to really remember
that. I'm surprised
that,
Alex Ferguson didn't pull his finger out and do something about that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Didn't he quit the FA Cup in 2000? That's crazy.
So the year after. And I think I seem to remember from playing a lot of Championship Manager 01, 02, that was the year that there was two Champions League group stage games. Group stages. So you had one group stage and you had a second group stage. So there must have been 12 games over the two group stages. I have no idea how they fitted all of this in. Somehow we all just put up with it and accepted it. But yeah. So there is precedence for it.
I've just gone on to Soccer Base and it says Saturday the 4th of November 2001, Liverpool 3, Manchester United 1. Monday the 5th of November 2001, Arsenal 4, Man United 0. So
yes,
they have played back to back on back to back games.
Exactly. That's what exactly the page and exactly the two games that I was looking at. Thank you for the confirmation.
That can't be right, can it? That surely can't be right.
Soccer Base is my Bible, as it is all of our Bibles, and I'd literally put my hand on it in a court of law if I had to. So there you go. That's what it says. But
Adam, have a listen to this from Rodri this week. He was asked here the optimal amount of games to play in a season. This is what he said.
Honestly, I don't know the exact number. I think from my experience, I can tell you that 60, 70, no. Obviously, I think between 40 and 50 is the amount of games in which a player can perform in the highest level. After that, everything comes, you drop because it's impossible to sustain the physical level. And I think this year we're going to go until 70, maybe 80. I don't know. Depends on how far you go into competitions. In my humble opinion, I think it's too much. I think we have to take care of ourselves. Someone has to take care of ourselves because we are the main characters of this, let's say, sport or business, whatever you want to call it. And yeah, I think not everything is money or marketing. It's also the quality of the show.
Do you think it will get to a point where, after playing so many games or being asked to play so many games, that the players will say, I don't want to be part of this, and they'll actually end up like going on strike or not refusing to play in such a big kind of calendar?
Yeah, I think we're close to that. I think you ask any player, he will say the same. It's not like the opinion of Rodri or whatever. No, so I think it's a general opinion of the players. And if it keeps this way, it will be a moment that we have no other option. I don't know what's going to happen, but it's something that worries us because we are the guys that suffer. So, yeah.
He dropped an IMHO there, which means it's serious.
Yeah, I mean, the key quote I take away from that is he said it's not about the amount of spectacles, it's about the quality of the spectacle or something along those lines. And that's very, very true. It's getting to the point now, like I said at the start of this podcast, like I didn't really care about the result last night. If we lose to Watford, I won't care either because there's almost just too much of it now. It's just oversaturating, and it's like I almost feel like I can't breathe. Like I work in football, and it's just constant. And then it's like I even look at like the Nations League now. That's come in to try and get rid of international friendlies and introduce another competitive competition. So a lot of it now just seems so needless, and you can see that it's driven by money. That it's almost like it's losing my interest as a fan, let alone the players who have to go out there and, like Rodri said, perform at a high level. So I think it needs to change. I'd like to see it change. I don't think it will change. It'd be very interesting to see if the players did go on strike, how that would actually work around the footballing world.
How it'd be received as well, to be honest. Because I think there'll be a lot of fans out there who go, well, you know what, you paid a lot of money for this.
Yeah, this is the thing, isn't it? Because it's such an easy comment to make. Like, I'd play 100 times a season if I was paid 100 grand a week. No, you wouldn't, because your body would collapse. That is like, Dave from Preston think he's superhuman or something, because like these athletes are at the pinnacle of physical performance, and they are most qualified to say I cannot perform 60 or 70 games a season, not some slob in a chair just like who sits there and watches the games. So like I completely agree with the players on this, and like I just said, like working in it even mentally because it's that thick and fast. I'm not looking forward to that Watford game. I don't care about it at all, and like I think it's almost forced City's hand because of the nature of the calendar to play a bunch of kids. And I think we may well lose that game. But that's the modern game, isn't it?
Yeah. Mark, I've had I had Adam from Stat City run the numbers about who's played the most minutes since Guardiola arrived at City. Rodri's played about the same amount of football at City as John Stones has, but he's done it in 3 years fewer. Fernandinho had six seasons under Pep and played 18,216 minutes. Rodri's had 5 and 2 games and played nearly 21,000 minutes. He's played 15 more games than Fernandinho in that time as well. So he's like, it's not even that he's playing more games than Fernandinho did in that spell. It's that Fernandinho was taken off and was given like a little bit more rest in games, like substitutions were used. He's basically played around 2,700 minutes more than Fernandinho did in the same amount of appearances. And then when you kind of expand the search a little bit wider as well, the top 15 appearance makers in the 8 years before Guardiola arrived, they averaged about 215 appearances. Under Guardiola, the top 15 are all 265. They're on average 50 more games under Guardiola than they were in the 8 years previous. There's an element of the schedule is bad, but also at the same time, Guardiola does use players a lot, doesn't he?
Yeah, mate, to be honest, you just listed off all those numbers there and I'm so knackered from all the football that's been, I have no idea what any of them meant. No, he uses them, yeah, no, absolutely, 100%. He does. I mean, but he rotates, right? He rotates. I think that has always been, that's certainly the narrative. I don't know if those numbers back that up or not.
What I will just say as well is like Pep also does win more than Pellegrini and Mancini did.
That is true.
Consequently, you're going to go further, like in every season.
Yeah. That's absolutely the case as well. Look, I think it's interesting what there will be. We're coming to a point, I agree totally with about oversaturation. The problem is that you have a lot of different stakeholders within football who all have their own little bit of the market share, and nobody wants to lose their part of the market share. And the bigger guys who you know, are slightly more powerful than the others want to take an increasing bite of it. And I think that, you know, this period of the season now, given that it's a bit of a different schedule than what we're used to, the there's a lot of conversation around it, right? It'll probably die off a little bit as we get into the season and you're right, teams go out of competitions and the schedule eases a little bit. But the one to watch really for me is the Club World Cup next summer, because that's FIFA, who previously didn't really have a stake in the club game. This is their big ploy, their big play to try and gain that and take that slice of that pie. And it's going to be tacked on to the end of the season, which will, to be honest, feel like it's never ending. I think, you know, Adam's spoken, you know, about that there, about how we're just working in football as well, because you can sense this now. There isn't a natural break point at any period of the season. One just merges into another.
Can I let you into a little secret? Last season when they got knocked out of the Champions League, I was secretly quite happy because I knew that the podcast season was ending a week earlier than it, at least a week earlier than it would have done.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? It's like, right, I can book a holiday or whatever. I don't know. I feel like I'm moaning about this job now, which is a good job.
No, it's awful to have, isn't it? But like, we are still working. That's the thing.
Yeah, no. I just think the whole. But it's not about working and it's not about playing in it. It's about supporters as well. I think the you only had to look at the I know the ticket prices was a thing last night, but another factor in it was that there's just too many games. There's just too many games for people to attend and to revolve their lives around and to book hotels for and to take days off work for and whatever. We're all feeling this because we're all part of it and we all have a stake in it. And I just feel that is going to be a real, you know, if we talk about strikes, it feels like, how could there ever really be a football strike, right? It's what health workers do, it's what teachers do, it's not what multimillionaires do, right? But I feel like if there's going to be a pressure point, it's going to be next summer when that is thrown into the mix and suddenly it just feels like non-stop football forever.
Adam, could fans go on strike? The amount of money that they have to pay for games, the amount of games that they have to attend?
No, because they're paying for a service and they can't afford it. So by default, they're not there, I think. I think the ones who go are the ones who can afford it. That's the sad reality. And I think, like, yeah, I think you'll get the odd person who'll feel defiant maybe about, like, I think there was strikes for, like, the Charity Shield because of the time of kickoff and things like that and it being in London. And that coincides with train strikes, which, of course, another sector. All these kind of variables that come into it. But really, like, you know, going to football matches, if you're an average fan, it's not an occupation, is it? You're not being paid to go, you're paying to go. And that's a bit of a different dynamic than like if a footballer were to strike. So,
but we there are fans who have started to pick and choose. Maybe footballers might be doing the same soon. I can only play in X number of games a season.
Yeah, like written into contracts, things like that. But you know, I think Grealish has been on strike for about 3 years now. It's about time.
Oh, come on, come on. right. Well, while we didn't get anything in the Inter game, Adam Keyworth correctly predicted the 2-1 win over Brentford on last week's show. That means the charity bet in mid-September is already at a lovely £525 so far this season. We've got three £10 correct score singles from William Hill. The winnings are going to the Man City Fans Food Bank support group. And again, they'll be doing a collection for Manchester Central Food Bank outside the Etihad ahead of the Arsenal game on Sunday. Go and see them. They'll be under the bridge by Asda right up until about 4 p.m. ahead of kickoff. And let's get this week's predictions for Arsenal and Watford. We've already had spoiler central on the Arsenal game, so let's run through that one very quickly. Kesh went for 1-0 to Arsenal, which is 14-1 and £140. Adam's 1-0 to City is 13-2 and £65 if he's right. And Critch's dour, boring, dull 0-0 is 12-1 and £120 if he's right. So Watford, what are we having for Watford? Mark, what are you going for that?
I try to put everything into the algorithm and factor in 2 days, massive changes, but also what is quite a likely score that is more likely to actually get money for charity, because whenever I do this, I always go for something stupid that has no chance of getting off. So I've gone for 2-0. Basically,
2-0 City is 11-2.
2-0 City.
Yep, £55 if you're right. I've gone on that same basis. I went for 3-1 City on that. I think that is the score that wins most often. So I've gone for that on the charity bet, which is 9-1 and £90. Adam, you're going to win us some money if it comes in.
Yeah, I don't care about facts or data or logic. I think Tom Cleverley's army are going to cook our kids 2-1.
if it happens, mate, 35-1. They're £350 if you're right. So, I mean, wouldn't be the end of the world. You've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for information on responsible gambling, head on over to begambleaware.org. And that's it for today's Blue Moon podcast. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks also to my guests for this one. Adam Monk.
Pleasure.
And Mark Critchley.
Cheers.
Don't forget, Patreon backers get a nostalgia episode every Monday. This week, I was joined by Bob Toole to induct Alano into the Cult Hero Hall of Fame. There's a clip of that coming up, and I'll be back next week to review the games with Arsenal and Watford. See you then.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
So many people hold that season in such high regard, in spite of everything that's happened since, which many people that don't support City would be surprised that City fans hold this season so high in their estimation, given what's happened with Pep and everything. But it's the essence of football, like the memories you make watching it and experiencing it with your friends and your family that make it live long in the memory. And for me, that season, and like with Alano and all those exciting players we didn't know anything about, and Sven, is what makes it so special. And that goal, like, I was lucky enough to be at the ground for that one. To say that I was there for that, and I can, you know, tell my son when he's a bit older, and it'll be a really proud moment for me. And it's like one of the best goals I've ever seen. Like, most free kicks, I think, tend to have that they're curled in, but that was almost as straight as an arrow, and it was so far out. I don't know what the specific yardage is, but it was about 35 yards, I think. And yeah, it scored at that period of time where we were on the ascendancy. There was such a feel-good factor. It was still warm weather. It's like the closest thing to like having a trophy to remember that period of time by is that goal.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast, and join us again next time for another episode.
Stay-
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.